The 1930s is basically my era of American history that I really enjoy the most. And I really like Army aviation in the 1930s, which as a military historian, I understand it's a little bit difficult to talk about a military not at war. People kind of like, why do you do that? Well, the military that fought World War II didn't show up overnight. And I'm fully aware of that. And I know all of y'all are. This is an audience that I'm going to take a great deal of liberty because I know that all of y'all know a great deal about what I'm talking about. So I'm just going to kind of, if you have questions afterward, I'll be happy to try to answer some of them for you. So the Army air power in the 1930s. We all know that World War I was the war to end all wars. No doubt about it. This is a poster that came out in 1918. And you can see where it says, a Merry Christmas. The war had just finished. You can see Santa Claus, Uncle Sam, and a doughboy, and they got peace, a gift to your nation. That is what the American people thought that they had just sacrificed so much for in 1917 and 1918. However, if this is the war to end all wars, do you really need a military? And that's the question. It's a question that goes on for the next 20 years. If you don't need a large military, then you definitely do not need a large air force. Especially at the end of the war, they talk about bombing of cities and stuff, and the American people were not really interested in doing that sort of thing in 1919, 1920. They had a number of questions about what happened. We had a great deal of sacrifice, cost a great deal of money. A lot of Americans died. We saw the pictures of what had happened in Europe. And then at the end of the war, all this sacrifice, we only sent a few airplanes over at a great cost, and then we took them and stacked them up, literally stacked them up in France and set them on fire rather than bring them back. The American people did not understand, why are you doing this? Aren't these perfectly good airplanes? Well, we know that they weren't, but the American people really, most Americans had never seen an airplane, so they didn't know. So we have the billion-dollar bonfire, caused a great deal of consternation. Congress got upset. The American people were upset. The Army was upset, but it was reality. Traditionally, the American people expect us to fight our wars, to win our wars, and then what do they do out of that? What's the first thing we do? First thing we do after we win a war? We demobilize. We send the boys home. You saw where Santa Claus was happy, they're all smiling. That doughboy was coming home. This is one of the better photographs from the period. This is New York, the city parade out in front of the library, and you can see the troops marching all the way up the street. They're all coming back. This is what the American people expected to happen, and they all expected to go home, and they expected the military to be reduced in size. So, in 1920, Congress provides what the American people want. The National Defense Act of 1920, it embodied the idea that the military was more of a constabulary, a police force, than it was an army. We still had a problem with this large standing army as our founding fathers did. The American people still thought that way. So these guys, they're all going home. There's a few more left in Europe. My grandfather was one of them. He'd been wounded, so he was there. He missed out on the big parades. My other grandfather stayed as an engineer to help rebuild part of France, contracted tuberculosis, and he came back. He missed all the big parades. But by and large, this is what Americans thought of, the parades, and this is a symbol that the war is over. So the National Defense Act authorizes only 17,726 officers and 280,000 men total. Total. Of that, the U.S. Army Air Service was only going to get 1,516 officers and 1,600 enlisted men. Now, of course, this is if Congress will provide the money. And what happens in the post-war period? Congress never, ever provides the money. During the 1920s, Congress, the American presidents especially, they were very budget conscious in the 20s, and the American people were not willing to spend money on the military. This is also the period of disillusionment creeping into the American psyche. We'd fought this war, and for what? the Germans were kind of coming back. Things are not going well in Europe. The French and British almost go to war. There's still fighting going on. It's right off the bat, they start seeing the war, the end all wars. Didn't really end all wars, maybe the big wars. So that's what their hope is. This is the period when they look at American industry from the First World War as the merchants of death. This is not an atmosphere where money is going to be available for expanding a small, and especially a small and brand new branch of the military. Aviation is still so new that it takes the Barnstormers flying around in the 20s for American people to actually even see an airplane, much less know how to vote for them, yes or no. Tell their congressman, yes or no. Therefore, the Army aviators started looking for a mission. If you don't have a mission, you're going to disappear. And they know that. So they start looking for a mission. That's the first thing they start doing, led by this man. You've all seen this photograph, I'm pretty sure. Billy Mitchell comes back, expects to be the commander of the U.S. Army Air Service. He's not. He's essentially made the deputy of operations. He keeps his one star temporarily. This is a brevet rank. He's not a real general. You still have to salute him. He gets paid like one. But when his term in his office is over and he goes to his next position, he will revert back to his permanent rank of colonel. I like this picture a lot because this is from one of the Dayton air races. And it shows everything we need to know about Billy Mitchell. He's got his hands on the prop. Look how dashing he looks. He looks pretty good. He looks like an aviator. And he's out there selling aviation from the very beginning. And what he does as the director of operations is start pushing operations to show the value of the Army Air Service to the average American. If people understand why they need an air service, they are much more willing to pay for it. If they're willing to pay for it, their congressman will be willing to pay for it, and the president will follow suit. So what he does is he starts a whole series of exercises and activities to prove the value to the American people at large. They start off by flying border patrols along the Mexican border. They go out and start doing forest fire patrols. They do aerial mapping surveys. They fly relief missions. There's films of them dropping bales of hay to starving cattle during snowstorms and the such. And again, it's designed specifically to prove that air power first can do what it says it can do, and second, it's of value to the American people. Two photographs, the Border Patrol. This one's actually taken from another DH-4 as they're going into land. This is a remarkable photograph. You can see them lined up at El Paso, Texas. This is 1920. Forest Fire Patrol. Another DH-4, a World War aircraft, left over, flying. This is extremely dangerous, by the way, because they're flying out where there's no roads, nobody, and no one has any radio to keep in contact with them. So when they go out, you may not come back. It's exceedingly dangerous. They start a series of record flights to prove that airplanes can do all sorts of things. They fly all the way up to Alaska. First time this is done, it takes them 40 days to fly up and back. 40 days to fly up and back. This is the photograph. There's Billy Mitchell over there again. This was his idea. He sends them off, and there's St. Clair Street shaking his hand and the other flyers who went along with other aircraft. Here he is wishing them well on their flight. It's successful. They get up and they come back. This is a major undertaking because, again, all of this is uncharted. This is truly exploring. As a matter of fact, it's called Flying Expedition. National Geographic covered it closely. But publicity is not always enough. So they do other things. Non-stop coast-to-coast flight. MacCready and Kelly in the Fokker. The first around-the-world flight. Everybody else in the world is trying to do it. All the other major powers are trying to do the same thing. We are the first to do so. And here's the flyers sitting around the globe. Get it? Showing the aircraft. This is a major undertaking. Extensive cooperation. This is a truly joint operation. The Navy actually helps the Army immensely. The Coast Guard's involved. The Army ground forces are involved. The State Department's involved. The Commerce Department's involved as they fly around the world. And it takes, again, April through September of 1924. Everybody follows it closely. This, around the world, newspapers are covering it. They go to Japan. They go everywhere. They're great heroes. They make a trek across the United States, stopping every place and getting little lighters and such and all kinds of presents. Very interesting thing. They fly back to Washington, D.C. I'm not sure if anybody can recognize who these people are. This is one of the air crew. And this person right there. Anybody know his name? Calvin Coolidge. That's Quiet Cal, Silent Cal. You see, he's not smiling. He's not real happy. The President of the United States goes out to bowling to see these four aircraft come back in. He shows up. They show up 4 hours late. Think about this. The President of the United States is cooling his heels for 4 hours waiting for these people. Not the best way to impress the President of the United States. You all know the story, and it's probably true that Coolidge is the one who said, why can't we just buy one airplane and let them all share it? Again, budget constraints, and they were trying to cut every tax dollar possible, and these things are expensive. The Army is actually giving the flyers a lot of money of what they have. Percentage-wise, they get a nice chunk. And at the same time, the Army flyers and Billy Mitchell's running around complaining about not having any money. George Patton is doing the same thing with tanks. There's other people doing it with rifles. There's other people doing it with poison gas. Everybody wants money. And these things are extremely expensive, and they only last a few years before they wear out. The thing we were probably best aware of are the coastal defense, the battleship trials of 1921. The big prize for the flyers, the big prize, was to prove that these airplanes could successfully defend the coast of the United States. The deal is, we always expected the two oceans to protect us. And what we were afraid of is that one enemy would attack us on the west coast, draw all of our forces to the west coast, and then the other enemy would attack us on the east coast. And there'd be no one there to protect them. The aviators, the Army aviators said, we can cover it until you could get more forces back with airplanes. This is why Billy Mitchell has to go out and sink a battleship. And that's why this is so important. This is, might be my favorite photograph of any Air Force history photograph. I love this photograph. This is when Billy Mitchell's putting together the 1st Provisional Air Brigade, and you can see everything that you need to see about Army aviation in one photograph for the 1920s. You see the bombers, the MB-2s. You see the fighters back. You can barely see them back over here. See what's back in there? Lighter than air. It's for reconnaissance, but they're still thinking, maybe we can drop bombs with this too. We know we can drop bombs with these. They don't know which way military aviation is going to go. How is it going to turn? Is it going to stay this way, or is it going to go like this, as some people are still prophesizing? The Navy starts continuing to work with lighter than air dirigibles. The Army uses the semi-rigid ones. They make a deal. Rather than both of them trying to buy it, they make a deal, and that's what they do. So I love this photograph. It shows everything you really need to know. They're lining up to fly around and have parades for everybody to see how important they are. Billy Mitchell collects all these aircraft from different units at one place, Langley Field in Virginia, to get ready for this, and they practice, they practice, and they practice. Well, we all know the story. These are extremely important exercises for the Navy. They get these brand-new German battleships, and they can test them. They're the best in the world. They can test them to see what they need to do to take out the best in the world. And they're going to let the Army aviators get involved. And we all know the story. Billy Mitchell cheats. He sinks it right off the bat. The Navy's not happy. The White House isn't happy either, because they just made these agreements for the arms treaties, the Washington Conference, coming up with the 775, 553, those all the battleships. The Japanese are upset. The Italians are upset, but the British and the United States are happy, and so the Germans have lost their fleet, so the world seems right. Just to let you see what we're talking about, Billy Mitchell with his own aircraft. This is the Osprey, is his aircraft, and you can see his personal emblem he always carried, and you can see the pennant, which, by the way, is on display if you ever want to go out and look at it at the Mitchell. And here's the MB-2. To show you how crude this is, You see the two larger bombs underneath, and you see the one little 100-pound one that's painted white? The way you do this is you fly over, and the first time you drop that to make sure that everything's going to hit. They have to borrow the bomb sight from the Navy to do this. So you drop this first one to make sure that everything's right, then you come back over and you drop your second aircraft. This is pretty crude stuff. It's effective because the newsreel cameras are running, and they film a battleship going down. And it goes down. The Osprey's one. This is in July 1921. This is the climax. The bombs are dropped, as you can see, onto the side. This is the one that actually sinks the ship. It doesn't hit. It uses the water pressure to break in the hull. Mitchell proved that an airplane can sink the world's most modern battleship. And this probably was the world's most modern battleship. And he proved it. The problem is, the Navy can sink them also. So do you really want to spend your money duplicating a second defensive capability? Even the Navy can sink battleships. So he proves one thing, but it's not enough. So toward the end of the 1920s, we're still trying to prove what air power can do. One of the great limitations is how long they can stay in the air. And if you're supposed to go and do the coastal defense mission, you better be able to get there, right? Well, instead of having to stop 25 times along the route, if you can do aerial refueling, it becomes important. So they're proving that you can do these things. There's the Fokker C-2 and the Douglas C-1. This is the question mark, named after they didn't know how long it was going to fly. So that was the question mark. And it's a good marketing tool. We kind of yuck it up, and it's kind of clever for the 1920s. It's clever. How long is it going to stay up? Well, the press gets interested. And not only do that, but you fly over the Rose Bowl. While everybody's trying to watch a football game, you're flying around this stupid thing going around and around over the head, right? Okay. Well, you get there's no TV, but you can get the people's attention. There's a couple of people in these photographs you should probably take note of. This person right here never smiles. Ira Aker. Carl Spotts. He doesn't smile very often. Pete Cassata. There's the commander of the Air Service at the time, or the Army Air Corps, actually, Fichet, General Fichet. Interesting crowd of people. These are the ones who end up controlling and commanding the Army Air Forces in World War II. And they're learning their craft the hard way. So, here we are then in 1929. Congress isn't willing to spend any more money. The American people like aviation, but they're not really wanting to pay more taxes. They're telling the congressmen, we like air power, but we don't know about it because air power is going to be used to bomb cities. This is the time that the newspapers are starting to show the lurid photographs again, or not photographs, but drawings of bombers flying over and setting cities on fire kind of stuff. So American people are not really happy with the idea of possibly killing civilians. That's not what we do. That's why we went to war. The Lusitania, they killed Americans on a passenger ship. That's not what we do. So at the end of the 1920s, not a whole lot of money's been, a lot of money, but relatively speaking, not a lot of money's been spent on the Army aviators. And it's encapsulated by the comment, again, made by President Coolidge, but it was echoed by many people, when he was asked at a party, why don't you spend more money on Army aviation? He looked the person in the eye and said, who's going to fight us? In 1929, the problems in Mexico are pretty much taken care of. Europe's peaceful. Who's going to fight us? Why spend the money when you can save the money and do other things with it? So they're not going to get any funding unless they can prove they can do the mission. After the crash of the USS Shenandoah in 1925 and the court-martial of Billy Mitchell, the American public opinion was motivated. The Americans were upset. They knew something was wrong, and they couldn't understand why. The trial showed serious flaws in the organization and the structure of the United States Army Air Service, which led to the Army Air Corps Act of 1926, and Congress creates the Army Air Corps, making it equal to the other combat branches of the Army, and they create a Secretary of War for Air, kind of like a Deputy Secretary of Defense is what we would call them now. It also authorized an expansion of the Army Air Corps all the way up to 1,800 aircraft. which is a lot of airplanes at the time, and 20,000 officers and men. But this is an authorization. Authorizations are nice. They're not worth the paper they're printed upon without having the actual money appropriated. The Army Air Corps Act included a 5-year program to buy airplanes, replace old ones, train pilots, build up fields, get everything ready to go. That was a 5-year program. Problem is, the money was never appropriated. Appropriations are very, very important, and they never come in the 1920s. Adding to the problem, we all know what happens in 1929, the stock market crashes. What is the traditional way when the stock market crashes or when there's a depression for the American people to get out of it? They cut spending. That's what we've always done, always cut spending. So the administration starts cutting spending. Congress continues cutting into the bone. So how is this going to help aviation? It doesn't. So the Army Air Corps Act is never fulfilled, never completely funded. President Hoover, by the way, as a Quaker, he was even less inclined to spend money on the military. He understood the importance of aviation, but there was just one more reason not to. So all these things are kind of working against the Army Air Corps at one time to the detriment of the Army Air Corps. On the good side, however, in 1930, these two men met and made an agreement. It's called the MacArthur-Pratt Agreement. Clever, because his name is Douglas MacArthur, and his name is William Pratt. He's the chief of naval operations, the head of the Navy, and he's the chief of staff of the United States Army. So these are the two, they're the top people in the United States Army and the Navy, and they come to an agreement. The Navy needs money too, and the Navy realizes every dollar that we spend on aviation for defending the coasts takes a dollar away from our aircraft carriers and our battleships. So let's make a deal. And what they do is they make a deal. The Army gets control of coastal defense. Traditionally, coastal defense is limited. It's not a problem because the Army has always been in charge of coastal defense. It's not a problem for the Navy because how far can a cannon fire? An artillery piece on a good day might get out 21 miles. It's not a problem. The Navy can handle that because they got the rest of the ocean to work with. Now, by their agreement, the MacArthur-Pratt Agreement, the Army is responsible for the aerial defense of the coast of the United States. This is a big deal. However, it's a personal agreement between these two men. And what happens if one leaves? I love it. Don't you love this picture? Doesn't that say everything you need to know about the Navy in the 1930s? 1920s, 1930s. It says everything you need to know. He retires. And what do you think the Navy does? The next people, they cancel the agreement. So after a full decade, in 1930, by 1931, all this effort really was for naught. They learned a lot. They did a lot of things, made some wonderful stores. We got some great parts of the museum. But for Army aviation, they haven't made a great deal of headway. And in reality, the aircraft haven't changed that much either. This is a photograph taken from maneuvers in May of 1930. Look at the aircraft, the Keystone bombers, and the ships flying. It looks really impressive. It's nice. But if you look at the photographs from the Ostfriesland trials just a few years before, these aircraft don't look that different. And more importantly, the Army aviators look silly. Something happens to them. In August of 1931, the Coast Guard has an old ship, the USS Mount Shasta, which is this one. And what they do is they tell the Army, hey, you can go out and use this for bombing practice and we'll sink it and you can have it. They say, that's a good idea. Well, thank you very much. We'll take you up on your offer. The press gets hold of it and they make a big deal out of it. The Army flies out. They can't find the ship. They get out there. The Navy guides them to the ship, flies them out there and shows them how to get out there. They try to sink it. You can see it's not sinking. They damage it, but now the Coast Guard considers it a hazard to traffic. They've just taken it and made it even worse, and so they have to go in and sink the ship. So the Army aviators are looking really foolish at this point. So all this time, all this effort, Army Air Corps Act, changes are made, and nothing. They have nothing to show for it. Let's compare the aircraft. This is the Keystone. This is probably the most important one of the late 1920s. And this is the MB-2 like Billy Mitchell used. This one has a top speed of about 98 miles an hour. This goes about 120 miles an hour. That's not marginally different. This one has a range of 400 miles at most. Again, short-range bombing aircraft. Let's look at the fighters. There's our friend Ira Aker again, by the way. He's almost smiling in this photograph. But you can see the Boeing P-12, which is probably the most popular fighter in this period for the Army aviators. And you can see very little change in this aircraft from 1929 through 1932. It has a maximum speed of about 190 miles an hour, just at 190 miles an hour. That we have cars that can go that fast now, but that's, you know, that was then, this is now. The cruising speed of this aircraft is about 160 miles an hour. This is not that far removed from the aircraft they're doing 110 miles an hour at the end of the First World War. It's better, but it's still nothing like what we would expect a real first-class aviation organization to have. But technology is about to change everything. A revolution in aviation is about to take place on several levels. And the Army kind of gets in on it, but a little bit behind the rest of the power curve. This is the first signs of it. The Boeing aircraft, the P-26, the P-Shooter, and the YB-9, which is this aircraft. The YB-9 has a top speed of about 188 miles an hour, which is, that's another 20 miles an hour faster. The P-26 will do about 234 miles an hour. This is a big jump. But look at these two aircraft. They look modern, especially compared to what you've just seen. But look at this. They still have, this one has semi-retractable undercarriage. This one has fixed undercarriage. The aircraft have so many forward-looking features, but so many backwards-looking features. Open cockpits, open cockpits. This is the last bomber the United States Army Air Corps buys that has open cockpits for its gunners. Last one. The pilot's in an open cockpit. You can see it from the backside. Imagine trying to fly at the speeds that this is now doing and work a machine gun to guide this aircraft or to fire this aircraft. The real change comes with this airplane, the Martin B-10. It has a maximum speed of about 215 miles an hour. This puppy can smoke. It can move right along. Its cruising speed is 183, which is the top speed of the other aircraft. This is the first modern aircraft the United States Army Air Service or Army Air Corps purchased, is this airplane. And it's the first one purchased in large numbers. It has all metal, retractable undercarriage. You notice it has a turret in the front. The gunners they can actually work their guns in the slipstream around the aircraft. The wings have been specially designed through, in part, the efforts of the people here at Wright Field. Instead of having the wings that had to reach out over to here, the wings were shorter, which meant it was more maneuverable, which it actually could carry on a military mission. The bomb bay is under, this is a strange, if you go out and look at our B-10 sometime, take a minute and just look at it, and you'll see how narrow it is down the middle. It's actually a rather pretty airplane. On the side, it was nicknamed the whale, because it kind of looks like a whale from the side. The bomb bay is enclosed, so it gives it more speed. In the 1932 maneuvers, the Army puts these things up against their fighters. It outruns the fighters. And this is a major change in American military policy. This airplane absolutely changes American military policy. Now, we start to think it can outrun the fighters. It can get through. We don't need a fighter escort for this airplane. It's this airplane that does it. It can outrun the fighters. Stop and think. This is before radar. The plane can fly faster than the fighters. If you're flying around waiting for it all the time, you're going to run your planes out. They don't have to come until they want to, right? So what you do is just wait till the fighters are gone, then you take and you send this aircraft in. And by the time you call them from the ground and bring them up without radar, it's already gone, drop its bombs, and it's halfway home again. So this is why Americans turned to daylight precision bombing in World War II, is what they learned from this. A certain guy was in charge of working some of these things. His name was Benny Feloy, and then the other guy's name was Hap Arnold. And he learns this lesson, and he carries it with him. there's a major change in the political world also. Franklin Delano Roosevelt becomes the President of the United States. President Roosevelt has a bad rap of not being pro-army or pro-aviation. That's not true. President Roosevelt, in 1919, when he was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, was asked before Congress, under oath, if he thought there would ever be a place for aviation in the Navy. And he said, somewhere in the future, bombers are going to make it so the Navy cannot operate. This is in 1919. Franklin Delano Roosevelt understood aviation. Yes, he had lots of ships and models and stuff. He liked the Navy. One reason he has such a bad rap is because Billy Mitchell, who supported him for president, who thought he was going to be made the Secretary of War for Air, but it never quite happened because Billy was kind of going off in the deep end at that point, and Roosevelt didn't need any more problems. Just before he died, and he wrote about it, had a meeting with Roosevelt, and he came out and told all of his friends, gee, if I'd just seen one airplane on the president's desk. Well, I don't have any ships on my desk, but I assure you I understand the importance of air power. So he's always gotten a bad rap. He's also understood about aviation. He's the first president we had to actually fly. He flew on the convention. We have Sacred Cow. He understood the importance of air power. But he, too, initially thought the way to get out of the Depression was to cut spending. So they did so. The previous administration and through his administration, I give this talk a lot of times to junior officers, and I try to explain to them what the Army Air Corps pilots and staff were going through was not terribly different than what they go through. Yes, the pitches are older, the planes are slower, but at that very time, Roosevelt and the Hoover administration before them were talking about furloughing officers. Furloughing officers. Now, what that means is you're still in the Army, but you're sent home. You don't get pay, but you're still in the Army. Try to find a job during the Depression when being known as somebody knows that you can be recalled back to active service at any time. It never goes through, but this was the level of concern about funding that it got to. A lot of these are the same things that officers, again, and enlisted people have to work through today. So Franklin Roosevelt becomes the President of the United States. Everybody thinks he's air-minded because he flew to the convention in 1932. And they're expecting a great deal from him. But things change for the Army. The new commander of the Army Air Corps is this man, Benjamin D. Folloy, Benny Folloy. One of the best pilots and one of the best operational commanders the United States Air Force and its predecessors ever had. But he wasn't a particularly good administrator. Outstanding leader. This is Half Arnold next to him. In 1934, President Roosevelt's Postmaster General found out that there had been some problems with the mail contracts issued under the Republicans before them. As a matter of fact, there were laws broken issuing mail contracts. And President Roosevelt and the American people were not interested in hearing holding companies and trusts, which everybody knew it was one of the major reasons for the Depression. And everybody, a quarter to a third of the workforce is out of work. They're not happy with this. President Roosevelt is not particularly happy with this either because it's pure collusion between the big mail companies, the airlines, and the small ones. They cut them out. It was to save, it was to be efficient. Yes, I understand that, but it was still breaking the law. So what President Roosevelt decided to do was cancel those air mail contracts and issue new ones. So he calls Benny Folloy into his office and asks him specifically, point blank, do you think that the Army Air Corps could fly the mail for a while? And being a good officer, he says, yes, sir, we can. Everybody said, well, he was caught off guard and he didn't know what to say, which is not quite true because for about a week and a half before the president met with Benny Folloy, the newspapers have been carrying stories about the Army flying the mail. So that was kind of disingenuous. But he was doing what he had always been taught to do, is, yes, sir, we will do it. The problem is he is using an Air Corps but still using old airplanes, underfunded. It's a daytime Air Force. And when is the mail flown? At night. They don't have the instruments for flying at night. They don't have the training for flying at night. They don't have the personnel. They don't have the locations yet. So they have to do all this from scratch. And they start from scratch. They make a valiant effort. Unfortunately, a few pilots were killed even before it starts. A few more die during it. As bad as tonight is, the winter of 1934 was the worst that they had had in 100 years. That was the Air Corps and President Roosevelt's bad fortune for this to happen. The weather was awful. These deaths are spectacular, and they make their front planes. Whenever a plane crashes in the 20s and 30s, it covers even the front pages of the New York Times frequently. And when you have Army pilots being killed, flying the mail, and this is a big deal, taking contracts away from companies. Well, it gives the Republicans, this is the first stick that they have to beat the Democrats over the head with, and by golly, they do a good job of it. They beat them pretty good. And it gets really nasty for a while, and they finally decide to reinstate new contracts. It takes them about 4 months to actually write the new contracts and get them. The problem for the Army is Benny Floyd gets a black eye. Everybody had the utmost respect for this man. Everybody did. Across the board, well, perhaps Billy Mitchell didn't. He and Billy Mitchell didn't see eye to eye. They were not particularly good friends. So, the airmail fiasco, as is known, Mount Shasta, airmail fiasco, the Army's not looking very good. Army aviators are not looking good. However, not long after the airmail fiasco and the Army steps out of the business, Hap Arnold leads a flight of B-10s from Washington, D.C. up to Alaska and back. It's the famous Alaskan flight of 1934. They are successful. They are efficient. They crack up one airplane, but they fix it in time so no one knows any difference. And they look like they can do this on a regular and routine basis. It's an 8,000-mile trip. They show up where they're supposed to on time. They get back when they're supposed to on time. And it looks really, really good. The problem is it's too late for Benny Floyd. After the airmail fiasco, he got caught up in another. He did nothing wrong except for not be forthright with Congress. There was a deal about purchasing trucks for the Army, and he somehow was on the periphery, and he made some misstatements. And when you read the transcripts of it, you can see, I see what he's getting at, but if you're not trusting him now, it looks like something's wrong, and his days as the Chief of the Army Air Corps were numbered, which is terribly unfortunate because he was a wonderful operational commander, one of the best we've ever had. However, it's too late to do anything to help Benny Floyd. But it's a major impetus for the next step in the evolution of the United States Air Force. The American people are so upset over the airmail that it forces a change to get some of the things that we know the Army, they wanted autonomy or independence, either one. They've been happy with either one. And so what they do is Congress forces the Army, and the Army accepts and does it, to create a new organization. They split the Army into GHQ Air Force, General Headquarters Air Force. And then for the first time, all combat aviation is put under one commander. This is what they've been wanting since Billy Mitchell at Samael in 1918. And they get it by the creation of the United States' GHQ Air Force. And they choose an operational commander for it, Frank M. Andrews. Now, he's wearing only a one star. He puts on a second one as a major general not long after this photograph's taken. Here he's in a B-10. It's at Langley Field. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the structures, but you can tell Langley Field immediately when you see it. This man is one of the better pilots. He also has had outstanding training. He was a cavalryman, which meant he was at the top of his class at West Point. Highly respected. All aircraft, all operational aircraft under one commander. So it's a principle the United States Air Force still holds dear today. We try to follow it as much as possible. Frank Andrews, all of his people wanted to celebrate the stand-up of GHQ Air Force with some spectacular. They want to have a mass flight to someplace or do something bigger than anybody else or go around the world or something. Andrews refused and said no. And instead, in August of 1935, flying this B-12, basically the only difference is the engines, and they've added pontoons, he goes out and sets land speed records with this aircraft. He takes it upon himself to do so. If he screws up, who's for fault? Who's at fault? Is it GHQ Air Force? No. He personally would have been blamed. And he personally would have been ridiculed and probably would have suffered the same fate as Benny Floyd did. This is a great risk on his part to do that. And he sets records with it. The other thing that happens is Benny Floyd is replaced by Oscar W. Westover. These names should be familiar to you. We have Air Force bases named after them today. Again, a well-trained ground officer. He was older. He learned to fly on his own, so he'd be able to do what he was tasked to do, so he'd have a better understanding. But he knew that he was not a particularly good pilot. He understood that. What he was good as an administrator. He was in charge of supply, training, and all the support side of Army Aviation, whereas Andrews was in charge of all the operational side. So he's the commander, commanding general, Army Air Corps. I hate showing slides like this, but sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. Org charts are boring. I'm sorry. But you have the Secretary of War and the Chief of Staff and the General Staff, and under them, look what the problem is. Andrews reports to the Chief of Staff. Westover reports to the Chief of Staff. Do you see the inherent problem? Military personnel know this. This is dumb. What happens if this guy wants something this guy doesn't want to give, or this guy, what happens? They get into a fight, and it's to the detriment of everybody. But it allows the General Staff and the Chief of Chief of Staff of the United States Army to keep control, and the Secretary of War to keep control over everybody. It's not a really good working relation, except a disaster was averted by very, very clever and simple decision by these two men, is to bring in Hap Arnold. Hap Arnold, he's an operator. He actually flew the most successful, he commanded the most successful area in the West Coast flying the airmail. His was doing pretty good. Fewest crashes, got the mail on time, everything he was supposed to be doing. He's the one, and again, this is the aircraft in which he flew to Alaska and back, doing everything he's supposed to do. He's an operator's operator. Everybody knows who he is. They make him, instead of an operator under GHQ Air Force, they take him and stick him under Oscar Westover as the assistant chief of the Army Air Corps. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Right off the bat, he has the gravitas to walk in, and all the operator guys were saying, hey, Arnold's got our back covered over here. And when he went over to the Westover's office, he could talk the operational stuff. So he was able to bridge the gap between the two sections. Brilliant decision on their part. The Army General Staff still controls them. Nothing has changed as far as that. But now that you have this triumvirate of three men making decisions, they all basically agree on several key principles. Oscar Westover led the pack. He wanted to win the support of the General Staff and the War Department by becoming, as he would say, a team player. Going back to the football analogy of the time, football was popular even at the time. As a team player, we will win support. He told people that over and over, letters, speeches, every time he could. The Army aviators are team players. In a directive he sent to the Army Air Corps, and by golly, you had better follow his directives. He knows how to get things done, like put you in jail or take your commission away, and everybody knew that he would do so. In a directive, he specifically stated, and I'm going to quote him, that the problems, most of the problems the Army aviators had stemmed from, quote, the aggressive and enthusiastic efforts, unquote, of some personnel outside of proper channels. Any names come to mind? Billy Mitchell? Benny Floyd? He's telling the Army pilots and flyers across the board, stop it, or there will be consequences. And this is in official publications he's getting the word around. To ensure that they got funding for the aircraft they needed, Westover called for, quote, effective teamwork, unquote, and, quote, hearty cooperation, unquote, from the entire Army Air Corps. And he didn't mean with him. He meant with the general staff. By cooperation, he means sending criticisms and recommendations through proper channels. Yes, if you got a criticism, that's perfectly fine, but follow procedure. Don't go direct to the press. Do not go direct to Congress. Second, don't send the War Department any harebrained ideas about funding. You know that funding's tight. Work with them and get what is absolutely the best we can get and work with them. And most importantly, never, ever say anything bad about the general staff in public or any measures recommended by the general staff. Again, going back to number one, use proper military channels. The days of Billy Mitchell are pretty much over. Here's another photograph, Billy Mitchell in his civilian clothing at the time, Hap Arnold. I think all of you here probably know that Billy Mitchell was supported strongly by Arnold during the trial. Arnold did some very silly things. He used government property to try to lobby Congress, and he got in serious trouble, was given the opportunity to get out of the service and be court-martialed. He said, I'll take the court-martial after talking with his wife. The Army thought better of it, said, I got a better idea. We're going to send you to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. It's one of the worst places an Army officer can be sent to, especially an aviator. It's one of the worst. He goes out to his exile, as he referred to it, but he learns his lessons and he starts seeing how to work with these Army ground people. In his autobiography, Global Mission, Hap Arnold, reflecting back 5 years after World War II on what his experiences were, let me quote you exactly what he said. They, the general staff, quote, seemed to set their mouths tighter, draw more into their shell, and if anything, take an even narrower point of view of aviation as an offensive power in warfare, unquote. He was referring to Billy Mitchell, if you've mentioned Billy Mitchell's name. Hap Arnold, who was his staunchest supporter, now at the end of his life realizes it was pretty dumb and that Westover and Andrews and he were right. Andrews, the papers are wonderful. You can go through, they had people to type up their letters for them so you can actually read, you don't have to worry about trying to read their handwriting. They're in the Library of Congress, and they're wonderful things to look at, the Andrews papers and the Arnold papers and the Westover papers, which were kind of folded into the Arnold papers. What Andrews told Arnold in 1931, this is before either of these two men have been put into positions of authority, and Oscar Westover would have agreed perfectly with this. What we have, I hate to read a slide to you, but I'm going to anyway, what we have to do is get down a proper system of training and navigation and bombardment. Remember the Shasta? Improve our equipment, this is before the airmail fiasco, and keep out of the limelight for a while until we know exactly what we can do. Not only does he preach this, but he practices what he preaches. Remember when he sets the world speed records? He takes the chances on his own, not for the service. Service before self is something the Air Force holds dear. This is as good of an example as you're going to get if you need to cite it. Now, what the American people were used to seeing is this. This is the 17th Pursuit Squadron. Can you guess? Okay. This is the Cleveland Air Races. This is in 1932, September of 32. It looks nice, but if you're on the ground looking up and you know anything about military policy, does this look very effective? Not really. What the Army Air Corps and the Triumvirate, Westover, Andrews and Arnold understand, and everybody under them understand that that's what they say, and they come to agree with this as well. You've got to make the Army aviation relevant to the American people. This is not relevant. It's entertaining, but it's not relevant. Why do you want to spend money on that? We can go and go down to the theater and pay a nickel and watch a movie. A nickel's a lot cheaper than paying for one of these, right? You've got to be relevant. And how do they do that? Well, Frank Andrews and his staff have a pretty good idea. This is November of 1935. They stood up in March. This is November. The GHQ Air Force shows the people of New York City why aviation is important. I cannot believe they got away with this, but they did. No way would this ever happen now. You see the airplanes buzzing around here and see the smoke being dropped behind two aircraft flying right along. And this photograph is taken from another airplane carrying photographers and the news services with their hand reels taking pictures of all this stuff. So this is seen not only by the people in New York City, but it's also seen around the United States next couple of days. Now, what the deal is? Why are they doing this? Well, what you're going to do if you're going to attack in a city is you fly over and you put the smoke screen down, and then the anti-aircraft guns can't see your bombers when they come over, right? They can't see your bombers. Now, people in New York weren't stupid. They were New Yorkers, yes, but they weren't stupid. This is 1935, 15 years earlier, 20 years earlier. Poison gas was used on an extensive scale. Everybody understood. Let me tell you about what air warfare was supposed to be like by this time. You send your first wave of bombers in. What's everybody going to do? Bombs start going off. What's the first thing you do? Run to your basement, run to your air raid shelter, right? That's the first thing you're going to do. Second wave of bombers comes in with poison gas. Where does poison gas go in World War I in the trenches? It goes to the low spots. So everybody's forced out from the cellars. Oh, by the way, this is truly horrific because they couldn't develop gas masks for children. So babies and small children are going to be asphyxiated as you're trying to get out, as the poison gas falls into your basement. The third wave comes along. See all these nice buildings standing up? They misunderstood how easy to do. But what you do is you fly over high explosives again, and incendiaries, and you set the city on fire. The burning cities will crumble on the people fleeing up from their shelters and dying. Either you got a choice, die of asphyxiation from gas, burn to death. This is pretty horrific stuff. Scares the dickens out of people. I guarantee you at that time, well, it's pretty horrific now. As compared to nuclear incineration, this is pretty good too. And this is why people were getting concerned in Europe. Scary stuff. Especially when you show them this. Can you imagine the EPA allowing us to do something like that now? Not to overmake a point, but this is the battery. And I hope I'm getting the idea across that they're doing stuff to show if you don't have an aviation service or the Air Corps that's well-funded, this can happen to you. And you think they were quiet about that when they spoke to people in public? No. Another revolution happens. This is the YB-17 when it shows up at Langley Field. This is March the 1st, 1937. The plane shows up. March at Langley Field. You can see the snow on the ground in the background. They're all standing around waiting for this to happen. This has got to be really uncomfortable. I've been out there when the snow on the ground. It's cold. The wind's coming off, and it can get cold. So they're standing around having a celebration for this airplane to show up. See what's over here? Can you see it at the back? Those are newsreel cameras. Everybody in the world sees this. It shows up. Hap Arnold refers to this airplane as air power you can put your hand on. It's not pie in the sky stuff. You can put your hand on this airplane. It's air power for real. Here's one of the photographs taken. General Andrews is over here shaking hands with the pilot. This is the crew they flew in. Lots of fun. And more importantly, there's the dog. You've got to have dogs on an Air Force base. 1930s, 1920s, we have them now, I guess. But the dogs are always running around. In addition, here's a Westover. He's not sleeping. He's reading a script. Andrews is actually reading the script, and you see the NBC, National Broadcast Company? Corporation, excuse me. National Broadcast, he's got his two stars on now. He's got his two stars. What they do is they shape public opinion. And they do this under the Roosevelt administration with the approval of the Roosevelt administration and the War Department and the General Staff through a series of maneuvers. They take part in other maneuvers. This one, in May of 1937, is out in California, and they're out at Muroc Dry Lake, which we now know as Edwards Air Force Base. They're out there, and they put these little targets, supposed to be cities, and they run these maneuvers that concentrate all the GHQ Air Force airplanes into one event so everybody can see the airplanes at one time and do all these things. And they read it over the radio. This is the national broadcast. This is carried coast to coast live. Americans, during this period, the radio was extremely important for Americans to understand. Remember what happens when a guy named Orson Welles gets on the radio and starts talking about Martians? This is Documentary Expression of the 1930s. There's a book about this, actually. And radio, if it's on the radio and you hear it for yourself, it's got to be true, right? Photographs are even better. So anyway, they have these outlined targets. They strike them. They read about it. And here they are talking about it, and the American people are listening to them live. In addition to this, they have another series of maneuvers. These are classified. They're not publicized. They take this ship, the USS Utah. The USS Utah was an old battleship, and they converted it. It can run off. This is from 1913. But you can run it from radio, and there's just a skeleton crew on board. What they do is they send the Army's bombers out to see if they can, you know, coastal defense, to see if they could find this thing out at sea. Well, the Navy doesn't play particularly fair. Billy didn't. They didn't. They gave the wrong directions of where to get there, but the Army found them anyway. They fly over, and Kurt LeMay talks about it in his book, flying over, and all the sailors were out sunning themselves because they had no idea that the Army was going to be there. And they flew over and dropped their flour sacks on. Probably could have killed somebody, but they caught them off guard. Photographs of the strikes were presented to the President of the United States, Secretary of War, Chief of Staff. They saw for themselves, with photographs, that the Army could do what it said it could do on the coastal defense. Again, they're looking for a mission. A mission equates to funds. So, coastal defense, they prove they can do it again. Then they turn right around a few months later and do it off the Virginia Capes. This is out in California. They go out to the Virginia Capes and do it again in even worse weather. Next step. This is air power you can put your hand on. In February 1938, GHQ Air Force proved what these aircraft could do. The State Department came to the Army and said, we need your help. The Germans, Benito Mussolini's son, actually, was one of them, and the Italians and the Germans were selling airplanes in South America. This was kind of like where we're supposed to sell stuff, and they're showing up. Monroe Doctrine, all these things, the State Department gets upset about these things. So they ask the Army, can you do something? GHQ Air Force steps up the plate and hits a home run right off the bat. What they do is they plan very carefully, and they take these airplanes, these YB-17s, and six of them make a 2,800-mile nonstop flight from Miami to Lima, Peru. And they did it in 14 hours. And guess what? They show up on time as scheduled. They end up touring around South America. American aircraft sales go up. By the way, this is still the Depression. Aircraft sales are important. Then, after their goodwill tour, they fly a nonstop from the Panama Canal to Langley Field. Now, what does this prove? First, they can do what they say they're going to do, right? First and foremost. Second, they know how to navigate now. Again, remember the slide I showed you with Andrew saying we've got to show what we can do in navigation. They can do this. Now they can do what, and now, not only can they defend the east and west coast, they can defend the Panama Canal, which is the most important military target the United States has outside of the continental United States. Because we only have one fleet. To get that fleet back and forth, remember that's why Teddy Roosevelt went after the Panama Canal, where we built it? They proved they can defend that. And, oh, by the way, these aircraft can actually make it out to Hawaii without any problem. This is a very highly publicized event. The newspapers are on the front page of the New York Times every day, which means every other newspaper in the United States carries it. Terribly significant. Terribly significant. But to make sure that everybody understands that, oh, this is routine. We can do this whenever you want, because if you're going to do a coastal defense mission, you've got to be able to do it every time, right? What they do is they don't have a party. In his land, there's a specific order that comes from Westover saying, no parties. We're going to show, and he specifically says, we're going to show this is routine and we can do it every day because we can. You've seen these photographs before. In May of 1938, the Army joins in maneuvers off the New England in New England, and they take part in some of the stuff off the New England coast. The problem is the Army does not write a script for the B-17s to be involved. So this person by the name of Ira Aker, non-smiling Ira Aker, who had just attended courses at the University of Oklahoma about public affairs, gets involved. They're figuring out they need public affairs officers. So what they do is they put him to work, and he goes to the newspaper, and he has a brilliant idea. Let's find a ship coming in to New York that we can send these airplanes out. And we'll use it as a publicity stunt. We won't be part of the maneuvers, but we'll be part of the maneuvers and show everybody. So what he does is he calls up the Italian ocean liners, and he says, hey, would you mind? And they say, well, this is great. It's free publicity. Of course it's great. So what they do is they send three of these YB-17s out. Kurt LeMay is the navigator on board, by the way. To make sure that this is captured, they stick the Army's best photographer, George Goddard, on board the aircraft. And he's the one who's taking these photographs. You can't really tell. The photograph is so poor, but it's so poor because the weather is awful. They can barely see. This is a gamble, and it's even more of a gamble because they're carrying a live hookup with NBC on the aircraft. They show up on time, dead on target, right where they're supposed to be, 776 miles. They run into the wrecks on national radio. This is a gamble, but they do it. In addition, they carried a bunch of reporters on board. Most of them got airsick pretty bad. It was a bad flight. But one guy's name was Hanson Baldwin. He was the most important military affairs writer in the United States in the 1930s. He wrote military affairs for the New York Times. And he was the most important. He was a Naval Academy graduate. He was not particularly pro-aviation or pro-Army aviation. He was pro-Navy aviation. After this flight, he completely did a 180. He became a staunch supporter of Army aviation. These photographs end up on the front page of virtually every newspaper in the United States. Newsreels show this stuff. Army flyers show up. It's very entertaining because the captain of the wrecks, when they flew over, he invited them to land and have lunch with him because he assumed that these were seaplanes. These are land-based bombers. Now, again, remember the importance of photographs and radio for the American people this time. All you got to do is also remember Munich had just taken place and the War of the Worlds. Very, very significant element. It's amazing how important one little flight can be. As part of these same maneuvers, in May, Hap Arnold gets involved with the Army and what they do, the Ground Forces Army part, and to show the American people again why aviation is very, very important to them, on the night of May the 16th, 1938, they made a deal. The city of Farmingdale on Long Island in New York, where there's a bunch of aircraft factories. He makes a deal with the city. At a certain time, they cut the power off. Now, of course, they made deals so that all the hospitals were taken care of, and they publicized this very carefully, that the hospitals all knew, so everybody who needed power had plenty of power. It's not a problem. They cut the power off and they sent Army bombers over like they were going to attack the city at night to get the point across. And NBC, dun, 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 carries live reports of what's going on. They hear the anti-aircraft gun firing. They hear the reporters talking on the radio, and it's like you're there. Again, War of the Worlds doesn't sound that fictitious now, does it? Because people are starting to see something. The American people totally understand what they're getting at. Arnold he's actually rather blunt about it. He's not crass, but one step away from it. In an interview on the radio after all this, he hinted to the radio public that without a strong air force, the United States would have another Guernica. Now, this is the famous painting by Pablo Picasso when the Germans destroyed the little town of Guernica, or at least made it appear that way. This is just a year before. The American people get it. The triumvirate has shown the American people why aviation is important to them. But a change is about to take place. Change always happens, doesn't it? Here's Oscar Westover. This is his A-17AS. A-17AS. just like our A-17 out here, except it doesn't have the guns and such. This is his personal aircraft. Oscar Westover, in September, on the 21st of September 1938, was flying this airplane with his sergeant, the mechanic in the back, and they were going to the equivalent of the AFA, the Air Force Association meeting in Los Angeles. He crashes and kills himself. Again, remember, he was not a particularly good pilot. He wasn't a bad pilot, but this is a hot airplane. It's an attack aircraft. He's killed himself. Everything seems to be in turmoil at first, but Franklin Roosevelt makes the correct decision again. Despite a number of recommendations of other people, because they thought they had a drinking problem, and for various and sundry other reasons, Franklin Roosevelt chose this man to be the chief of the Army Air Corps. In November of 1938, Arnold takes the oath of office. You'll notice he's wearing civilian clothes. You notice who's giving him the oath is just a clerk. I don't know the clerk's name. I don't have a clue. It's not on the back of the photograph. It's a different world from what we know now. But this man's taking the oath of office, and he still holds the same ideas that the triumvirate held. In November 1938, Roosevelt had a meeting with some of his key advisors, and he left some people out who were not particularly strong supporters of Army aviation. He held a secret, quiet meeting. Hap Arnold was there. He writes about it in his memoirs, Global Mission. The president, about 6 months earlier, was sitting in his car listening to the radio while his son was in the hospital at Bethesda. And Franklin Roosevelt spoke fluent German, and he listened to Adolf Hitler giving his Nuremberg speech in 1938. And he turned to everybody and said, "This means war," in the car, right there. He had a pretty good idea of what he wanted to do. He turns to Hap Arnold to lead it at this time. He embarks the United States on the most ambitious building program since the World War, the First World War. He wants the Americans to be able to build 10,000 airplanes a year. This, I personally think, is the equivalent of John Kennedy saying, "We will go to the moon in a decade." This is what sets off the chain of events that leads to the creation of the United States Army Air Forces that by 1943 was able to subdue our enemies overseas. So the 1930s were not wasted. They are ups and downs, backs and forths, two steps forward, three steps back, two steps sideways. But Hap Arnold referred to this meeting as the Magna Carta of the U.S. Air Force. When he becomes commander of the Army Air Forces in World War II, he puts this into practice. And in 1939, the war breaks out in September. A very, very good friend of Frank Andrews becomes the chief of staff of the U.S. Army, George C. Marshall. So we have another supporter in place, and Hap Arnold is able to continue the work from there.